You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handled them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Pushkin.
Hi, Malcolm.
Hi.
How you feeling?
I'm good. I'm good.
You have a new podcast, a new series in your podcast. It's called Development Hell. Why did you want to make this in this moment? Because Hollywood has just had a pretty traumatic year with the double labor strikes, both with SAG and the WGA. It's not in the best of shape, I would say. Why this series in this moment?
I've forgotten how we came up with the idea. It was some combination. I think it was Neil Lawrence, who is the producer of the series. But we were just sitting around and chatting, and we came to the conclusion that failure is more interesting than success in many ways. And I don't think we were thinking of the kind of macro situation of Hollywood, but maybe in the back of our minds that Hollywood is doing more failing than succeeding at the moment. And there was something incredibly poignant and fascinating about telling the story about the movies that never made it. So that was just a seed. And then we had no idea what we'd get. And then we went out and started talking to people and we're surprised, I think, at how amazing the stories we heard were.
In terms of failure being more interesting than success, in the early 2000s, there was a period where you believed your book, Blink, was going to be turned into a movie. Did you regard that period and the film not being made as a failure?
Well, yes, although it hurts a lot more if you're the screenwriter or if you're the director who wants to direct it. I mean, that's your world. It's not really my world. So I was simply really selling the rights to a story that I'd written and to, in this case, a book. And I was pitching some ideas for the screenplay. So I wasn't really, it wasn't like front and central for me the way it would be for somebody who is actually involved with making the movie.
So take us back. When the book was sold and you go out to Hollywood where there's interest, what was that week like when you're trying to make it into a movie?
This is the story we tell in the book, in the episode. It was nuts. I mean, we got it. We got what everyone wants, which is a bidding war.
This is the early 2000s.
Early 2000s. At a time when Hollywood was in one of its moments of overpaying for everything. And so we rode the bubble and we went from studio to studio. We had a meeting at every studio. I mean, I have to say, the pitch was just amazing.
What was the pitch?
Basically, what Steve Gagan did was he read my book, Blink, and there's a chapter there about whether you can tell when someone's lying to you. Who's good at it? What are the clues? And so he had conceived this idea of a movie about someone who had this gift and how they would use it. Now, this was before, there were all these TV shows in the early aughts that were, there was one called Lie to Me, and there was another one. This was before all that. They were all picking up on the same thing. So this was, at the time, was this kind of, the notion that there might be somebody out there who's a kind of super detector of truth.
Right.
Was brand new.
A human lie detector test.
Human lie detector test. So Steve crafted this story around someone with this ability, who's a boy, who's a young man who has a very rich father who he's desperate to impress. And we worked out our kind of patter. Steve Gagan is incredibly charismatic. And
by then he had written the film Traffic.
Traffic, Syriana. He just finished the movie Syriana.
So he was in high demand.
He was in high demand. Oscar winner, this handsome, insanely charismatic man with this kick-ass story. I was along for the ride. We attached Leo DiCaprio. I mean, it was just kind of, it was the dream. It was a beautiful
triumvirate.
We just drove around from studio to studio, fielding calls from our agents as the bidding got higher and higher and higher. It was amazing. It was like everyone's kind of like one of the most fun 2 days of my life.
Did you always regard those 2 days as some of the most fun? Or did you sort of like fall back in love with them as you made this episode for the show?
Well, I hadn't thought about it in a long time. It's 20 years ago. So we decided to do the story, and then I realized, oh, I have one of those stories. And then we thought we'd kick off the series with me calling up Steve Gagan and reliving those 2 days years ago. And in the course of that, he told me the reason, which I did not know, about why the movie never got made, which is hard. It's a hard, I'm not ruining it. It's totally heartbreaking. In fact, we were in all the tabloids the next day after the show dropped, because it was such a kind of like jaw-dropping reason why it never got made. So yeah, I forgot about it. And I was looking back on it, and I was like, you know, something happened to me that almost never happens. The number of kind of bidding wars in Hollywood is vanishingly small. The number of people who can get a bidding war in their first time out is vanishingly, you know, even smaller. I had this kind of miracle, hilarious miracle.
And did you know it was a miracle in the moment?
A little.
I mean, I got to say, Steve Gagan, DiCaprio, and Gladwell, I feel like that feels like a...
less miraculous.
It's a little dream teamy.
DiCaprio is, you know, just beginning his incredible...
Post-Titanic.
Yeah. Post-Titanic. I mean, he's really, really hot. Steve had just won an Oscar. I mean, so yeah, we had several advantages. I subsequently became very good friends with one of the studio chiefs that we pitched, and he would always tell me, that was insane. Like, the kind of fervor over the screenplay. So...
the bidding war.
Yeah, the bidding war. But, you know, the kind of, it's not so much the money, it's the excitement. It's, you know, when an idea grabs a bunch of people simultaneously and you realize you're onto something.
That's funny, when I write notes, you always look down right when I'm writing this. Are you seeing what I'm writing? Mm-hmm.
Can't help it.
It says, failure more interesting than success. And it was me trying to write the word original until I saw you watching me write the word original. It's not just about the bidding war. It's about what they were bidding on, which in that period were a lot of creative new voices that were producing original screenplays. This was before the Marvel boom. This was before the kind of endless fascination and fixation with tent poles. And throughout this series, it does seem like you keep coming back to a period in the industry where they prioritized artists more, where they were more interested in discovering and producing new artists.
Yes. I think that's true, that there is, I mean, every generation has a kind of golden age that it refers to. For my generation, or if I were a screenwriter of my vintage, the golden era would be that period in the kind of early aughts where, you're right, there is, it's pre all this kind of formulaic Superman, Spider-Man, Marvel-y stuff.
Are you a big Marvel guy?
I'm not. No, I don't. You could tell, I paused there trying to figure out what do you call these creatures? I've forgotten. even as a kid, I would only ever ask for a comic book when I was home from school sick. And I would then be at a loss as to what comic book to ask my mom to get me from the drugstore.
So in Canada, some kids were reading Captain America. You were reading Chomsky.
No. I was not reading Chomsky. My mom, I think we always defaulted to the Archie. So I wasn't even doing the superheroes. I didn't understand them.
So when they started making these movies in the mid-2000s, pretty much after Iron Man this happened, did it make sense to you?
Well, I was only dimly aware. You know, my part of the reason why my experience with Blink was so fun is that I didn't have a stake in it. My self-esteem did not rest on turning Blink into a movie.
It didn't?
No.
Because the book was a bestseller by that point.
The book had done very well. I was someone who wrote books. I have always, you know, over the years, I've dabbled with writing screenplays. It's always ended in disaster. And I've never taken it personally. I've just accepted the fact that, A, I'm not very good at it, although I really enjoyed it.
Why do you think you're not good at it?
It's a completely different, it's like asking, you know, a tennis player why they're not good at catching a football.
I mean, Steph Curry can play basketball and golf.
Steph Curry.
You're Malcolm Gladwell.
But Steph Curry, by the way, although he's a good golfer, he's not a PGA level. He's not winning the Masters.
I think when he retires, there's a chance.
There's a chance.
There's a chance.
There's a chance. Okay, but, you know, that's...
I did just compare you to Steph Curry.
Yes, yeah. Which is very unfair to Steph Curry to be lumped with me in any capacity.
Hey, he didn't write David and Goliath.
These are different. These are profoundly different skill sets.
When you say the screenplays ended in disaster, what did that look like?
I wrote a screenplay many years later about three African-American siblings living in Atlanta whose father is in jail. And the eldest of them, a woman, is a brilliant medical researcher. And she gets embroiled in a little bit of medical fraud with large-scale implications. But it's all about the intersection. It was called Druid Hills, which is an area of Atlanta where Emory University is. I was really interested in the intersection of white and black Atlanta and about what it would mean for someone from the South Side, you know, the black part of Atlanta, trying to make it in Druid Hills, which is old white money, and someone, an outsider, trying to make it in the world of scientific research. Anyway, it was sort of a rich topic. I sold the idea to HBO, and I went through 17 million rewrites, and then it just hit a wall.
That was a disaster.
No, I enjoyed every minute of it. My point was, it wasn't a disaster because at no point, like I said, did my self-esteem rest on this thing being made into a movie. I was a lark. I had some time on my hands and I really, really enjoyed it. And I do believe that the experience of writing a screenplay for the first time made me a better writer.
Mm, how so?
It just makes you much more aware of pacing, of character. I mean, writing a screenplay is a good one is an insanely difficult. So it's like you get a kind of intensive lesson in what it means to tell a story. You know, that's just useful in life. I mean, I think I still kind of benefit from the lessons I learned in that period when I was trying to write the screenplay.
The script that you wrote, that you were just talking about, the one that ended in disaster, it sounded on the surface and purely thematically and racially like the script your friend was writing in the episode called The Birthday Party. Perhaps you want to talk about that one and why you wanted to tell some of that story.
My best friend, Charles Randolph, who's a screenwriter, tells the story of trying to adapt a book, a memoir written by a guy, a young lawyer in New York City, relatively young, a white guy, who is abducted, true story, by three young black teenagers who are incredibly naive and who think that he's rich and that they can simply go to empty his bank accounts. They don't understand any of the kind of things about how ATMs work and how eventually they kind of give up and let him go. And there was great interest in this book in Hollywood, and Charles was the one who was asked to adapt it.
Charles has worked with Anna McKay. I think he wrote The Big Short.
Won the Oscar for The Big Short. He's wrote The Birthday, The Interpreter, Love and Other Drugs.
Underrated movie.
Great movie. I think it's a great movie.
Really good.
Yeah.
People need to...
The screenplay, by the way, I'm of the opinion, having read the screenplay and then the shooting script, the original screenplay that Charles wrote is even better. I mean, it's just fantastic. Anyway, so he was asked to write it, and his episode is all about why you can't turn that into a movie.
Why couldn't he tell that story?
Well, you have a dynamic where you have a educated, privileged white person who has been abducted by three young, very naive black kids. They're 16, 15, who are living in a kind of, this is all the real details, living in a position of squalor, who are violent, who are profane, who are having sex in front of him with prostitutes. I mean,
this is a real story.
that's the real, that's the story Charles was given. That was in the book. That was the book that the guy who was abducted writes a memoir. Right. And he describes this is what happened to
him. So he's adapting it.
Yeah. So he's adapting it. But the setup, the premise, how do you do that without being seen as condescending, dismissive? For the screenplay to work, the way Charles describes it is so much better than I am. I can. But like, you've got to give the kids something more, right? They have to be more consequential. They can't just be these kind of kids we look down on, who we dismiss or we loathe or we, which requires in turn the protagonist, the guy who's abducted. He has to have a real emotional engagement, both with the kids and with himself about how he's thinking about them and treating them. In other words, in order to tell the story for the screen, you got to change the story to the point where, among other things, the protagonist, the lawyer who was abducted, became profoundly unhappy with the movie that was being made out of his life story, right? Because he didn't do any of those things. You know, he was just a guy abducted by three thugs. You know, that's how his perspective.
And there's the added complication that Charles, your friend, is white.
He's white. Although we talked about this, you know, it's one of the most interesting parts of the interview. That's fine in the sense that it's not like a white person telling a black story or a black person telling a white story. This is a story that's black and white. I mean, we have two sets of characters at the center of it, three black kids and a white guy. So, you know, it's not off limits to a white screenwriter. On the contrary, we're as interested in seeing this through the eyes of someone who's white as we are through the eyes of someone who's black. It's just that the dynamic in the story requires some kind of attention for it to rise to the level of a movie we want to see. No one's going to commit to seeing an hour and 40-minute movie where they just dismiss the people driving the plot as being not worthy of their attention or sympathy or, right? So that's like, in many ways, the thing that makes the story kind of so dramatic and horrifying on the page limits its potential as a movie.
The other element is that you say there's a separate advantage from being someone who doesn't belong in either of these worlds that comes from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're making the case, and I think it's a fair case, that Hollywood, especially in 2024, where we started this conversation, seems less and less interested to encourage outside voices to tell stories that may not be their lived experience.
Yes. We got into this as well. This is something I've talked about long, many times with Charles. Both of us are of the opinion that we have become kind of overly obsessed with the problem of representation. You can't just have stories about black people that can only be told by black people, or stories about Asians that can only be told by Asians, or you can't limit the human imagination in that way. And sometimes the most interesting perspectives on one group come from someone who's not of that group. We all benefit from it, and it doesn't have to be, their perspective does not have to be congruent with the thing that they're describing. That's my point.
If Hollywood let this happen more often, I think we would get movies that would illuminate and we would get movies that would enrage. Either, I think, in my opinion, and probably yours, is a good thing. I think anything that produces a real response,
mm-hmm,
that tries to push the boundary, that tries to be interesting, is worthy of our time and attention. I suppose the argument is the people who've been permitted to tell the stories that are not their own have, for the history of cinema.
Oh, been white guys. Yeah, exactly. No, Hollywood walked into this problem. They created it for themselves. They're like, you know, you can't do 100 years of white guys making movies about everybody else and then make an argument. Hollywood had a long history of inviting in outsiders. If the director of Gone with the Wind was a black woman from the South, first of all, how much more interesting is the Gone with the Wind through the eyes of a black woman from the South?
Right? I would then want a biopic made about that woman.
Yes, that's right. So if they've been doing that forever, we would obviously feel very differently. Mm-hmm. This is an own goal by Hollywood. Through their reluctance to open the doors, they invited this problem on themselves, right? So now they're stuck, right?
Big picture and thinking about the industry in this moment, its fixation with representation. Do you see the industry moving away from that, or do you think we have a long ways to go in that regard?
Well, we are in a period of correction where, after years and years and years of having white guys tell everyone's story, now we say, okay, if you're going to tell a story of someone who's not a white guy, you can't be a white guy.
Mm-hmm.
As a corrective, I think that's really, really important. you got to like write the ship, bring in some outside voices. And if that's the fastest and most efficacious way to do it, God bless, right? I would eventually like to get to the stage where we're all allowed to tell whatever stories we want to tell.
Sooner than later.
Yeah.
Before we play this episode with you and M. Night Shyamalan, part of the story he's going to tell is around the period that you sold Blink, like this really exciting time where there were constant bidding wars for scripts and an investment in original voices. Why did you want to talk to M. Night Shyamalan?
I'd met him once, and he's incredibly charming. And that's one, probably the least important of the reasons. But the second reason is what he's done is, I think, really extraordinary, which is that he's set up a successful studio outside of Hollywood. He makes all the movies he wants to make. He writes them. He directs them. Do you know how hard that is to do? Like, in addition to being creatively brilliant, he's also managed to master the kind of business side of it in a way that almost no other, I mean, Woody Allen in his heyday is the only one who kind of...
I know Tyler Perry does some of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very, very short list. It's very hard to do. He does, he's sitting in Philadelphia and he's making movies that millions of people are watching. Like,
sounds like the dream.
I just have enormous respect for anyone who can do that. And so I was just curious. I got his number and called him up and asked him, do you have a story?
You called him up out of the blue? Cold call?
Well, I texted him because I'd met him before. And so I said, Night, you know, remember me? We met years ago. And then he sent me back the picture that was taken when we met. So I knew that he remembered it. It was with Elton Brand, who was the, you know, the general manager of the Sixers. Knight is a huge basketball fan.
Former Duke player, drafted by the Bulls. I was raised in Chicago, loved him.
Oh, right. Great player, Brand was.
Great player.
No, so I just asked him, do you have one of these stories? And he said, I actually do. I have one. The story you're about to hear is him talking about, I think it's better to say it's not just the movie he hasn't made, it's the movie he can't make. He can't bring himself to make it. And what's fascinating about the interview is the extent to which Shyamalan, who is, by every indication, an extraordinarily insightful person, particularly about himself, is unwilling to kind of dig into the reasons why he can't make this movie. It's like he admits it. At one point in the interview where he goes, my favorite point in the whole interview, he goes, Malcolm, I'm shutting down. The idea is so central to some part of his psyche.
The episode plays like a therapy session where the subject is on the verge of a revelation and kind of knows what it is, but can't quite bring himself.
And I'm not good enough of a therapist to get them to put it on the table.
I'll take a crack at it next time.
I cannot express how much I love Night Shyamalan. I just thought he was amazing.
As people are about to hear this, it's the thing you most love about him, the fact that even after all the movies he's made, even at the age that he's at, he remains, I think, a little bit like you, a dreamer, still willing to dream, still willing to risk some of himself to dream. Is that the part you most sort of identified with or were moved by?
Well, I think he's a lot more creatively courageous than I am. The thing that actually, one of the things paradoxically that appeals to him the most is that he has failed. If you look at his career, and he's made like what? Let's say he's made 10 movies. Some number of those are, maybe let's say 4 are critical successes. Mm-hmm. 6 are commercial successes. And the last 4 are like, just not, right? They're duds. He just gets up after one of those and goes up back again. And more than half the time, the next one works again. I love that kind of resilience, that willingness to learn from, and also the understanding that anyone who is in a creative world understands that's the way it is. If you think you can do 10 movies and every one of them is Godfather, you're out of your fucking mind. And the only way you can make 10 movies is you accept the fact that along the way, something's not going to work. And my job is to learn from that and move on and not get destroyed by it. And he's not destroyed by it. Between that and the fact that he's set up his own world, just makes him out there in Philly, makes him a hero to me.
Failure. It's more interesting than success.
Yes, absolutely.
This is Malcolm Gladwell and M. Night Shyamalan.
Thank you, Sam.
I've had such a exceptionally curated career. Every movie I've ever written since 18 has been greenlit to be made into a movie. You've seen everything I've written, you know, except for this one that we're going to talk about. So it's an interesting...
It's always a twist.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Development Hell, our mini-series about the lost scripts of Hollywood. Today I'm talking with M. Night Shyamalan, one of the best-known filmmakers of the past generation. Suspense, thrillers, the supernatural, psychodrama. You know his movies, I'm sure. Unbreakable, The Sixth Sense, Split, Glass. Something like 15 films in the last 30 years, which collectively have grossed billions of dollars. M. Night Shyamalan's stories have haunted a lot of people over the years. This episode is about the story that haunted M. Night Shyamalan. We've talked a lot so far in this series about movies that never got made because there was something wrong with the story, or because someone on the outside had a problem with the script. This episode is about none of those things. There is nothing at all wrong with the story Shyamalan has never told. And maybe that's why he never told it.
There was the first real script that I felt kind of lightning bolt inspiration that came to me. I was 22 and I'd just been married, just got married. And I wrote a kind of a love story, and it's called Labor of Love. And I was writing it and I wrote it. I almost can remember everywhere I wrote it because it was such a special experience of writing. By that time, that was my third feature that I'd written. I had made a movie already in India.
Tell me this, a little bit about the story. What was Labor of Love about?
You know, Labor of Love is essentially a story about an older couple, mm-hmm. and the wife saying, "Hey, it's an anniversary," and he forgets, and all of this stuff. And they've been together a long time, and she's just like, "I, you know," essentially expresses, "I do all these little things for you our whole life, and you don't. And I'm not sure what you want from, you know, I'm not sure you love me, you know, I'm not 100% sure." And that's not a great feeling, you know? And he's baffled, right? As all guys are, just baffled at this.
What do you mean?
Yeah, what do you mean? What do you want? I love you.
Who goes to work every morning? Who goes to work? What do you think I'm doing that for? Yeah. Okay, I get it.
See, I don't want to say too much of it because I tend to think of these things as magic.
Just give us a taste.
Yeah, she passes away unexpectedly, uh-huh. in very tragically. And before she died, he said, "You know, what do you want me to do to prove my love to you? You want me to, you know, swim across an ocean, or climb a mountain, or walk across the United States? What do you want me to do?" She's like, "Just walk to the store and get me something on your own, because you were thinking, you know, something small like that." Anyway, she passes away. And he's an older man. He's in a, you know, late 60s, 70s kind of thing, out of shape. And he's so devastated. He makes a crazy decision to start walking across the United States for nothing else but just to show his wife who's passed away in case she can see. And I wrote this in 1994, right? So, no cell phones, no nothing, no internet. And he just begins this trek, and it's a kind of a vision quest a little bit. He starts to think about his life and his time with his wife and from when they were kids. And he's physically in threat as he's doing this. And slowly the country starts to get a hear about this guy, and they're trying to urge him to get there. And it's so crazy. Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And then the country kind of gets on board with the feeling of doing something irrational to show your love for the person that you care about. And I'm not gonna tell you the ending, but it's really poignant, the idea of just doing something so the other person can hear you.
So you're 22, you're very much in love, you've just married your wife, who you've known for how long at that point?
I met when I was 18, so I've known her for 4 years at that
point. And in this period of love-struck youth, when you are, you know, in love with your young wife, you write a story about an older couple.
Yes.
Where the question of the man's devotion to the to his wife is in doubt.
Yes.
And he has, in other words, I thought you were going to say, I wrote this at 22, I was just married, very much in love. It's about this young couple who embarked on a... you jump forward 40 years,
yeah,
and you start looking back.
Yes.
So yeah, in the period where you are of greatest infatuation, your impulse is to go to the end of the relationship and work backwards.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've always been driven by familial nightmares. You know, the sanctity of the family being jeopardized. You know, later it changed into aliens and ghosts and you name it, but ultimately it's still about families and mm-hmm. whether they can survive.
What is it about you at a period of young love when you're already thinking about the kind of, not the dissolution of love, but the final stage of it? Why would you jump ahead?
I guess you're thinking about your life and what you want it to be and where it could go wrong. And maybe I was thinking about what do I want this to be at the end of the journey? You know, mm-hmm. 40 years from now, 50 years from now. I hope I've lived the life the right way. And of course, there's going to be a lot of mistakes along the way. Mm-hmm. But I don't have fears like the other people have fears, in the sense of like, I knew I was going to marry the second I met her. You know, like those things. I fear getting a call that something bad happened, you know, mm-hmm. and that's very prevalent and still mm-hmm. 30 years later.
Yeah. But you're asking yourself the question of what is the most tragic outcome of mm-hmm. young love is what you've described, is that one party loves and the other party doesn't realize they're being loved. You put your finger on something that's like that's a deeply resonant anxiety.
It is. I probably from the dynamic of me and my wife that, you know, she married a dreamer, someone who's completely content to stare out in an empty room and just do that all day long and think about an imaginary world with imaginary people and feel fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, I'm right here. You know, what about the real life we're living, you know? And so the struggle has been, you know, I've heard all of those stories of, you know, from, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald to you name it, you know, all our heroes and how they struggled with their personal life versus their artistry. Mm-hmm. And is it a one or the other equation? Sometimes it feels that way. And for a lot of people, it feels that way. I've tried to see if they can be feed each other, and it feeds the movies, the feeling of love for your wife or for your kids, or, you know, and what does that mean? How can you imbue it and you guys feel it when you see the movies and mm-hmm. really the stories that I make?
And the hardest thing to explain to your spouse in that instance is that to them, you seem inaccessible in that dreaming. But from your perspective, I'm putting words into your mouth, but there's a certain amount of commonality between the way I approach this and the way that you do. What's hard to explain is that we're not being inaccessible. And in fact, the relationship we have with our loved one is what makes our dreaming possible. Mm. Right? They're the engine of it. They're not outside of it. It's their presence and support and structure and love and whatever that permits us to wander off and in our imagination and find comfort and joy in all of that. I don't know. It's like, it's a very hard thing to explain to someone that our inner lives are contingent on someone from the outside.
Yes. You know, so finding love and then building a career from there felt the right building blocks. And so that movie was the beginning of that. You know, when writing this movie, Labor of Love, it was, it was coming from such an interesting place, and I was writing ahead of my abilities at that point. I was just kind of going by this inspiration of love, I think.
What do you mean by writing ahead of your abilities?
You know, I didn't have as much craft at that time. This is oftentimes your career is an equation of craft and inspiration. And mm-hmm. so lacking in craft and at 22, but the inspiration was at a 10. You know, that feeling when I was writing it, well, this feels beautiful. This feels lovely. You know, I love this feeling, how it's coming out and how I can see the characters. And in retrospect now, 30 years later, can see that, you know, I was really listening to the characters almost like a novelist and following it. And so the end result is I wrote this screenplay that ended up becoming a bidding war from my parents' guest bedroom where me and my wife were living in the guest bedroom. The best bedroom was pink. It was for my sister. It was just a, you know, we had to get out of here kind of feeling. and this script went out and there was a bidding war and someone offered this amount of money and then that amount of money. And it was crazy. And I was a kid and I'd run down and I'd be like, Mom, they offered this amount of money. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. But I'd only directed this little movie in India and they saw it as a big, big movie. And this was back in an era of Hollywood where the entire system was geared at original movies. The system was built to nurture original movies and the spec screenplay markets, screenplays done on speculation was the kind of gold rush. And so if there was an incredible screenplay that came out, everyone would read it immediately and it would go in this bidding war because that was the food that was feeding the engine at that time to the movie theaters. And so I was luckily kind of grew up in an era where what I love to do, which is original movies, was really celebrated and promoted. And so everyone bid on it and we sold it to 20th Fox. You know, I was attached to direct and then I flew out and I put on my graduation suit, which I didn't because I didn't have many suits. So I wore my old suit. And then they listened to me about how I would direct the movie. And then they subsequently fired me off the movie. So and so it was devastating, just absolutely devastating.
What did you do wrong in your pitch to be a director?
That's really interesting, a question. I would say I wasn't a director yet. I had more practice at writing than directing it. Of course, sitting in a room telling a chairman of a studio how you'd make a film and they're asking certain questions. And, you know, I don't know if I had a chance at all, you know, before I walked in there in retrospect.
Knight, you're now, how old, 53?
Yeah.
You look at 53, you look 30. At 22, you must have looked 12.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct.
No one's going to give you $50 million to direct a movie when you look like a 12-year-old.
Yeah, and I'm in this ill-fitting suit, which makes me even look younger because you're like, oh, did you wear your big brother's suit or whatever it was? And I remember the feeling. I can remember the feeling pitching it to the chairman and the heads of the studio and going, I don't believe what I'm saying. Yeah. And I'm guessing, I don't know, I'm gonna learn, you know, as I do this, because I can see it in my head, you know, so I'll learn. And they took me, I was very painful. Then I ended up, you know, they talked me into kind of, hey, rewrite it for some other A-list directors of that time. So I had a chance to be in the room with some, you know, at that time, the top directors, and they would say, do this, do that. And I just couldn't, I would rewrite it and it would get worse. In retrospect, some kind of mojo curse I put on it. And it could never bloom into fruition. So there was lots of directors that two or three directors that tried. So what was really weird about this movie, it represented some kind of, you know, connection with the universe. And I think for a little bit, I thought that was a one-off and that it's never going to happen again. And that was the fear. That screenplay just became something of a mythic thing for me, like, oh, I'll never get that back again.
M. Night Shyamalan writes his masterpiece, and then he's haunted by it. More after the break.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Wait, so what's the next stage in the saga of Labor of Love?
So Sixth Sense happens, right? I wrote it a few years later. And wonderful outcome. Everyone wanted to make movies with me. And I said to Fox, I would love to have that screenplay back. They said, oh, do you want to make Labor of Love? And I said, well, no, I'm thinking about making another movie, which was Unbreakable, that I was writing at that time about comic books, even though no one had making comic book movies. And I thought no one would ever see this movie. But it was something that interested me. And I said, I was really into genre now. I was like, okay, genre is my way. Labor of Love is a very emotional movie. I think I have that as my base tendency to be emotional. And I think until I found genre to balance it, I was too much for people. Cause like I start at a 9, like I'm at emotion. If you and I are talking over drinks about something, I'll be already emotionally to be, there. And I think genre helped me balance that, You have to meet the audience where they are. This is something I learned in my mid-20s. When you're telling a story, meet them where they are and don't lecture them and demand that they come to you. You come to them. So you start tonally where they are. So it's a tough world and we have cynicism. That's how we get through our lives. We balance that to protect our softer parts genre does that. It comes in and it balances. I have this feeling about movie making or art that it has to have the right balance of light and dark. And that's when it rings true. Mm-hmm. The love of a mother to a child has a selfish component. You have to have, a controlling component. Then it rings true. There's also the beauty, the pure love, of a parent to a child. But if I can get both things in there, then it rings true and you start to see yourself in it. I think genre allows me to show you the light side. Because of that, I can go very dark. I mean, I've killed off more protagonists than anybody. This is like dark stuff. But that's because underneath, I do feel the universe is a benevolent place. Yeah. And I feel that from that. So genre has helped me balance things.
Is it fair to say that genre, particularly horror, or the supernatural, it lowers the stakes in a certain way? What does it allow you to, what's the best way to describe the way it's
protective.
When you get really down to it, I'm just this sentimental dude that's overly earnest. When I speak to people, they think it's gamesmanship. It's not. There's no game at all. I love it. I hate it. I'm terrified. I'll tell you openly, you know, everything. And when we do things like comedy and all this stuff, those are ways to protect ourselves, which I understand and I can use as well. And genre is if I can show you edgy, dark things and show you, because I do have an edgy, dark side as well. I just deploy it at the right times. That allows me in the balance of things, in the audience's eyes, in their emotional journey, it's earned then when I do the car scene in Sixth Sense with the mom and the child. You know, I've earned it by titillating them and scaring them in a certain way. There's a balancing act that goes on, which I think is important for me to acknowledge that this is a conversation with the audience.
Yeah.
That it's not just a lecture.
Yeah. Labor of Love is, are you saying there's no supernatural? It is a straight?
Pretty much, yeah. Just a straight.
You say pretty much. What is it?
Pretty much. The reason I say pretty much is there's a tiny bit of spirituality and love.
Yeah.
And so that I do represent that in there, that things are bound a bit, that there's some, you know, inspirational, magical things that happen sometimes, you know, that's related to love. So that's all. But there is no genre in it, as we would say. This opportunity came, I would say, you know, 15 years later, where I could make that movie with literally the best actor in the world. And the person that I would want to make a movie with more than anybody. It was being squeezed between another movie that I was making for a big studio. And I made the wrong decision. And I didn't make it. And when I think back on it, now knowing me.
Who is the actor?
Well, I don't want to say just because.
Okay.
But it's more about the emotional.
Yeah.
Stuff that we're talking about rather than the kind of the titillation of it, of the names and things like that, if we can, because just because, you know, it meant so much to me and him, and I didn't do it, and it was literally because I just wasn't in the right place, and I was making destructive decisions at that time. In retrospect, I now, having gone through, you know, iteration after iteration of who I am in front of the public eye, I with absolute certainty can tell you I should have made it at that time.
Dig into a little bit more why you didn't. Is it on some level terrifying to actually make real something that you think of as being so perfect, or something like, if something comes in a lightning bolt, is it scary to?
It was a lot. No, I wish I could say it was something that defendable. It was literally, I think I wanted so much to be accepted. I was in a phase of my life where I was willing to, I think, give away the things that were precious to me to be accepted. And I was so tired of fighting the fight all the time, these original movies and, you know, doing things. And then I didn't have the protection of genre with that movie. It would just be me and this incredible actor. And at that time, I felt like that's a very vulnerable thing. And that it's just an emotional movie, and the world's going to just trash me and trash us. And that's the that was the fears, but I was perhaps scared of giving up what I had, not very admirable reasons. They were coming from wanting to be accepted, from wanting money, you know, in other forms, or needing money, or whatever it is. And so, you know, I failed it because I was impure. That's how I feel about it. And should have 100% done it. This particular actor was, you know, sad by the decision. I would say maybe another 8 years later, it came up again. And then this time I was the one that said, hey, let's go make this. And the same actor wanted to do it and then went off and did another piece, a big kind of thing that they were a part of. And it was successful, the thing they did. But a little bit of it was we missed each other. You know, we missed our moment, you know, a little bit.
But the movie wasn't done with M. Night Shyamalan yet. Not at all. Back with more after the break.
Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Co. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
How does the way you relate to the movie, how has it changed over the years? You're now, it's 30 years have gone by.
Yeah.
Do you look at it and think about it and see it differently now than you did when you were 22?
Right now, I wouldn't change anything about it. And we'd make it as a period piece in 1994. The music, the Moors, the time, you know, which sadly feels incredibly innocent. It almost feels like, you know, let's take a stroll around the garden, you know, I'm so tired from the stroll. Let's lie down. It's like, you know, when we see a period piece, we're like, wow, that really wore you out to go walk around the garden. You know, and that's how we feel about like 1994. Oh, yeah. We thought we were really being really bad when we did this. You were just talking with your boys in the basement. How sweet. Yeah. And you were just, all of you just talking about girls because you love girls, you know, how sweet, you know, like it feels that way. And when I think about it, it's very nostalgic of a time gone by now and a way people might have reacted.
Oh, because the way as the hero goes on his journey, as he's walking across the country is responding to him in a way they wouldn't respond today. Is that your point? That in a kind of internet age, it would be different.
Yeah, it's so hard now to unwind it and think of a moment when you didn't have access to every piece of information in the history of man. You don't know where your cousin is and where your uncle is and where your sister is right now. No, you don't, right? You know, 1994, we didn't know where anybody was, right? And you get a letter or you would, if something happened, it would take a while for you to find out. All of those ideas of being present primarily is gone. Our understanding of what it is to be a human being is almost gone because we're never just here anymore. And this phone that's sitting near me as I'm doing this podcast is pulling me even right now. I can feel it. It's pulling me. So I'm partly here with you, but it's stolen my soul a little bit, you know? And that was just a different era. And that's all part of the that time period when I, you know, when I try to rewrite it, when I'm trying to make it better, I'm scarring it. It came out in one thing like that, you know, as this kid was just feeling something.
When was the last time you read it?
I probably read it. It came out a third time with this particular actor. A third time. It was 4 years ago. So I read it 4 years ago. 4 years ago when we talked about it again.
What are the odds you'll actually do it?
I'm just a strange creature, bro. So if I say to you, absolutely never, as soon as we click off here, I'll probably go make it, right? I've thought about it a lot. Do you do it more as a ritual almost to honor that part of you in all of us that came from a pure place, regardless of its success, regardless of what would happen? There is a kind of a wise warning about labor of love, that there's something where you're blind about the labor. Oh, I always wanted to make that movie about blah, 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 whatever it is. Or I always wanted to write that thing. It's a labor of love for me. That automatically means you're blind a little bit. Some massive, you know, blind spot exists there. There is that wisdom, acumen, to be careful of your labor of loves. That meant that you were kind of obsessed in a way about something. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the case here. I feel, even as we talk about it, like, you know, I could go do this in another year and do exactly the way I said it. I it's funny. I had this conversation with someone in my office about it. I said, I don't know if the world even wants to remember feeling this way anymore. It's painful to remember that we used to feel this way. And it was okay and wonderful and celebrated and common.
When you say feel this way, you mean get swept up in what that man was doing?
Well, yeah, this amount of the expression of love, you know, whereas today it's our relationship to our emotions is so being attacked. We're not supposed to have our own feeling anymore. We're being manipulated by algorithms constantly. Mm-hmm. And distraction, and so the AI world is already deciding how we live and experience our lives, and maybe that's the absolute reason to make it. I don't know. As I'm talking to you, this is probably the deepest conversation I've had about it, because it is a kind of like, are you still torturing yourself about this movie, bro? After 30 years, this odyssey is that. There's been opportunities, and there is one now of a wonderful filmmaker that wants to make it themselves. Mm-hmm. The same story. And whether I'm okay with that.
Are you?
Bro, I don't know. I don't know if that feels like... I don't know. I'm almost shutting down when you're asking me that question. And I haven't I've actually shut down in that process too, so you know
someone just called you up and said, someone famous calls you up and says, Knight, I've read the secret screenplay.
Yes.
How did this person get a hold of it? They just heard through the grapevine?
Yeah, and it's happened before. Somebody wants to make it. Oh, there's every few years somebody wants to make it, and I could just let it go. Yeah. Just let it go and let someone put their point of view on love. So it's this screenplay that represents the purest version of me that's on a page, and it has been chasing me like a ghost or like haunting me. It started my career, and I got to do all these amazing things and continue to just have these incredible opportunities. And really, it's like a part of me that I betrayed at one point, and now I can make it now. I mean, today I can make it right now. And I think probably with this same actor. And even as you and I are sitting here, I have all these reasons that are holding me back. Yeah. So so I don't know what this screenplay is to me and what this movie is to me. Maybe it's the softest part of me. Mm-hmm. And so scared to show you guys that.
You said that your great fear at the time when you wrote it was that you would never have anything, write anything so pure again. But listening to you, my fear about it is that had you made it, then what followed may not have happened. In other words, having as one of your very first screenplays something so perfect, like fueled all of this extraordinary productivity that came afterwards. And that had you made it and had it been a big success, maybe you would have been kind of paralyzed by that. Like the fact that it's unrealized allows you to keep going and, right? Mm. What is the curse of the one-hit wonder? The curse of the one-hit wonder is someone who is unlucky enough to have written their greatest song first. It's just bad luck. Mm. And everyone looks at the second and the third ones and says, it's over for you. Well, it's not over for you. It's just out of order, right? Whereas the same thing, only put the one-hit wonder's breakthrough hit 10 years into their career. And we think, oh, what a progression, right, towards...
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, I keep, you know, maybe you're right, the unfinished nature of that keeps driving me. You know, the movie I'm just editing now and finishing, when I think of it, I have a little bit of magic feeling about it. And I'm like, oh, this is reminding me of Labor of Love. When it's feeling effortless and right, you're going, well, where did that come from? Mm-hmm. How do you do that? And you're like, oh yeah, that's how it felt at 22.
But then here's the other fear I have, that what if you made it and it wasn't magical? Mm-hmm. Then you would also have destroyed this thing that you've been able to look at throughout your entire career.
Well, I can tell you at 22, I wouldn't have made a particularly great movie at that moment. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been, you know, up and down, flawed and this and that. And then when we jumped forward to the first time with that, the most incredible actor, I wasn't in the right emotional space to have made it properly. Now that we're really getting serious about it. Yeah. So that wouldn't have worked out either, because I just was not where I am right now.
One last question. What does your wife say? She was present at the creation.
That's a great question. I think she's seen me torture myself for 30 years about this. In her mind, you know, for a while she kept asking me, why do you keep killing off the wife? You know, like in Signs. And she's like, why do you keep killing off the wives? And I'm like, no, it's because I'm so scared to lose you. You know, she knows I wrote it for her. And so it's kind of already in our lives as it already happened. It already existed and was made and was so lovely. You know, I have this check from back when we used to get checks and from 20th Century Fox. And it was my first check that I got, and I have it framed. It's in my office. Mm-hmm. So it's, if you come to my office, which you will, it's there. And then if you go into the cafeteria, there's a poster of a mock-up of a poster that 20th Century Fox made for Labor of Love. And that's hanging on my wall. Oh my God. On my wall is all the movies I made and a movie that wasn't made.
It's your own ghost. You've created your own ghost.
True.
Knight, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much. I really, really, really enjoyed this.
You're so lovely. Thank you for having me on. I was learning something about myself too as we were talking. You're a good therapist, man. I was starting to get there.
This episode was produced by Nina Bird Lawrence and Tali Emlin, with Ben Nadaf Hafri. Editing by Sarah Nix. Original scoring by Luis Guerra. Engineering by Echo Mountain. Our executive producer is Jacob Smith. I'm Malcolm Gladwell.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.